Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 9, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the legal and policy implications of closing Guantanamo Bay. My name is David Ray, and I'm the Associate Director of the Practice Group here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Mr. John C. O'Quinn, a partner at the law firm of Kirkland & Ellis, and Professor Stephen I. Vladek of American University Washington College of Law. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. Mr. O'Quinn, the floor is yours.
Thank you, David. Well, good afternoon. Again, my name is John O'Quinn, and by way of background, I was at the Department of Justice when the Supreme Court decided the Boumediene case and litigated a number of the Guantanamo habeas cases that followed that decision in the district courts here in D.C. Guantanamo has been back in the news with the Obama administration's recent swap of five detainees to the Taliban, and that has also brought with it increased attention to the statistic reported by the Director of National Intelligence that approximately 30% of the detainees released from Guantanamo have returned to hostilities. What we haven't heard as much about recently, but is still an issue being debated, is the idea of closing Guantanamo and transferring the detainees held there to a facility located inside the United States. Now, as you will recall, President Obama campaigned on closing Guantanamo and even signed an executive order saying that it should be closed a year after he took office. There was significant pushback that followed from within Congress, and the debate still continues over the symbolism associated with Guantanamo as well as U.S. national security interests. Some have described Guantanamo as like a modern-day Alcatraz. It's impossible to break in or break out, and the United States has invested millions upon millions there to make it a state-of-the-art detention and intelligence-gathering facility. But in addition to being physically remote, the question is whether there is legal significance to wartime alien enemy combatants being held outside the United States. In Section 1039 of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2014, Congress put that question to the Justice Department, asking it to assess whether or the extent to which relocation of a detainee currently held at Guantanamo Bay to a facility in the United States would give that detainee additional rights under the immigration laws or additional constitutional rights. One of the principal concerns, I think, that animates this question is whether relocating detainees onto U.S. soil would create an increased risk that a detainee could be ordered released into the United States by a court. And as I'll explain, I think that is a real risk. On May 14th of this year, the Justice Department issued the report required by Section 1039. That report ultimately concludes that, quote, Guantanamo detainees relocated to the United States would not have a right to obtain relief under the immigration laws. But respectfully, I submit it does not answer the most important question that Congress had asked, which is whether relocating detainees to the United States would grant them any additional constitutional right. In a sleight of hand, the report says that, quote, any constitutional rights applicable in a particular context for a Guantanamo detainee relocated to the United States should be no greater than those that would normally apply to a similarly situated alien present in the United States in that same context, end quote. But that wasn't the question asked. The question wasn't what would their rights be compared to other aliens in the United States. The question was whether relocating them to the United States would grant them additional constitutional rights beyond what they currently have at Guantanamo. I think the answer to that question is clearly yes, and that is presumably why the administration did not want to answer it. But more about that in a moment. More importantly, in my mind, the report does not grapple with the fundamental distinction of being within or without the United States for purposes of what remedies are available for habeas corpus. But that distinction was critical to the one case that has addressed the issue of releasing Guantanamo detainees into the United States, the D.C. Circuit's decision in February 2009 in Kiemba versus Obama. In fact, the report doesn't mention that particular decision, and that is a surprising omission for a variety of reasons, but most importantly because in Kiemba, the district court, Judge Urbina, had ordered 17 detainees at Guantanamo released into the United States without any supervision. The D.C. Circuit ultimately reversed in a 2-1 decision. And as we look at the report and consider more broadly the policy and legal implications of closing Guantanamo Bay, the Kiemba decision is thus important. First, it clearly held, and the D.C. Circuit has since reiterated, that the Due Process Clause does not apply to aliens without property or presence in the sovereign territory of the United States. In other words, whatever their right to seek habeas relief, the D.C. Circuit held that aliens outside the United States do not have the full panoply of constitutional rights. Now, that principle has been recognized by the Supreme Court in cases from Eisentrager to Zadvydas to the decision in Verdugo in which the court held that the Fourth Amendment does not apply to the search and seizure by United States agents of property owned by a non-resident alien located in a foreign country. So I think clearly bringing Guantanamo detainees into the United States would have at least some effect on their constitutional rights because it would give them some rights that they do not have under controlling precedent. What those rights would entail, how courts would approach it, would remain to be seen. For example, would it give them the ability to require notice before they are transferred out of U.S. custody? Would it give courts the ability to police the conditions of their confinement, and so forth? And these are not issues that the Justice Department attempts to address in the report that it issued earlier this year. Kiemba is also a very important decision because it specifically held that the district court could not order detainees that were held outside the United States to be released into the United States because, quote, never in the history of habeas corpus has any court thought it had the power to order an alien held overseas brought into the sovereign territory of a nation and released into the general population, end quote. The D.C. Circuit thus reiterated the long-recognized distinction between aliens within the United States and those outside our borders in determining what the scope of the remedy was available. Now, I think notably when it opposed certiorari in Kiemba, the Obama administration, in a brief signed by then-Solicitor General Elena Kagan, placed substantial weight on there being significant constitutional distinctions between aliens located inside the United States versus those located outside the United States. It specifically distinguished the immigration laws at issue in Zadvydas as applying to aliens inside the United States and not having extraterritorial application. It noted that Zadvydas itself drew a critical distinction between an alien who has effected an entry into the United States and one who has never entered. It emphasized the numerous decisions of the Supreme Court that confirmed an alien outside the United States has no constitutional right to entry or admission into this country, and ultimately relied on what it called a, quote, clear distinction between aliens outside the United States and aliens inside this country or at its borders, end quote. Now, you can certainly argue, and I expect that the administration would, that there are distinctions between aliens who are formally admitted to the United States and those who are simply housed within U.S. territory without status as enemy combatants. And the report goes on at some length espousing principles of deference and wartime comity that would support that distinction. And while having litigated those very issues when I was at the Justice Department, I find that part of the report to be edifying. I think it's ultimately a fairly thin reed to rely on. I mean, to recap, of the four federal judges to consider the issue in Kiemba, two would have found that habeas permitted release of 17 detainees in the United States. One of those two would have then only considered whether the immigration laws would permit some additional detention for some period of time. And so if you relocate detainees from Cuba to within the United States, I think as a practical matter, the calculus may change. And the judges who are making those decisions will surely change. You can bet there will be new rounds of litigation and that the precedent developed by the D.C. Circuit over the past 5 years would not be controlling because these issues would be litigated in the circuit where those detainees would be housed. Finally, I think it's worth noting that these are not likely to be academic issues. At some point, either the executive branch will conclude that the conflict with the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and associated forces, to which the 2001 AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, applies, has come to an end, or a judge in some case will say that it has, at least for purposes of assessing detention. And since detention of enemy combatants is not punitive, but simply ancillary to the president's war powers, a new round of litigation will begin over continued detention, especially over individuals that no country is willing to take, or individuals that we're not willing to send them back to their home country for humanitarian reasons. As long as they're detained outside the United States, binding D.C. Circuit precedent would prohibit release into the United States. But once they are relocated within the country, I submit that all bets are off, and the decision of Judge Urbina and the opinion of Judge Rogers in the Cambia case, I think, illustrate that the niceties and the details of the immigration laws will not be a substantial deterrent. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to Stephen.
Great. Thanks, John. So I guess I want to start by just sort of taking us back to where this all begins, which is, you know, the current state of the Guantanamo population. And I think it's worth reiterating. I mean, where we are today with the Guantanamo detainees is we have 149 men who are still there. And the question is whether closing Guantanamo means ending their detention or just relocating them. And I think in that regard, it's worth separating among three different categories of detainees. On the one hand, there's the group that's slated for trial by military commission, a group the size of which is really going to depend upon what the D.C. Circuit ultimately decides in the pending case of Al-Balul, and a group that's really not going to be affected one way or the other, because there's no question that the authority to try individuals before a military commission will survive the end of the conflict. Indeed, there's longstanding precedent for that. The second group, which numbers somewhere in the 70s or 80s of those 149 men, is those individuals who have been cleared for release. And this is perhaps the most problematic category from a human rights perspective, because these are detainees who, from the government's perspective, no longer pose a threat to the United States sufficient to justify their continuing detention, even if they might have at one time. This is arguably the group that could be most easily transferred as a matter of law and policy if it were not for the transfer restrictions in the National Defense Authorization Act and the Obama administration's increasing unease about the security situation on the ground in Yemen, the country from which most of these detainees originate. The last category, those detainees who are not slated for trial and who have not been cleared for release, those detainees who are, from the government's perspective, too dangerous to release, but not possible to try. That's really who we're talking about. I mean, when the question comes down to the future of Guantanamo, the legal and policy implications of closing Guantanamo, that's really the key. It's this group of men, which is somewhere between 45 and 70 of the detainees, depending upon what happens in the military commission context, depending upon how many of those men ultimately end up being held not triable. And the debate is really about this category. And at this point, I think we have to step back and talk about the point that John raised about the AUMF. So the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, was enacted in September 2001, almost 13 years ago, when we pulled combat troops out of Afghanistan, perhaps as early as the end of this year. There's a very strong argument that authority to detain under the AUMF, at least with regard to Taliban detainees, if not also with regard to Al-Qaeda detainees, will begin to expire. Indeed, in her plurality opinion for the Supreme Court in 2004 in the Hamdi case, Justice O'Connor expressly said that once there are no longer combat troops on the ground in Afghanistan, quote, this understanding may unravel, unquote. And the understanding to which she was referring was the notion that individuals could be detained for the duration of hostilities. So as John rightly points out, there's going to be a series of questions once we pull out of Afghanistan about whether the government really does have continuing power under the AUMF to hold these detainees anywhere, not just at Guantanamo, but even if they're transferred into the United States. And so in one regard, the conversation about what to do with Guantanamo is really a tail that's wagging a different dog, which is the conversation about the AUMF. You know, there's been a number of proposals in Congress to either repeal the AUMF altogether, to scale it back to repurpose it so that it's more focused on groups like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you know, the group that probably poses more of a threat to the U.S. today than core Al-Qaeda does. But there's also this question of whether there's separate authority to continue to hold this last category of Guantanamo detainees, even once the AUMF no longer so provides. So one argument is that Congress should provide a separate statute going forward that allows for the continuing detention of these men. It's also worth pointing out there's a provision in the U.S. Code already that could be used for this purpose. Back in 2001, as part of the USA Patriot Act, Congress enacted Section 412, which is codified today at 8 U.S.C. 1226A. And Section 412 of the Patriot Act specifically contemplates the detention of non-citizen terrorism suspects in the United States. Now, the statute's only really worried about the first 7 days. So it says basically that once a non-citizen terrorism suspect is picked up in the United States, the government has 7 days before they have to either release him, charge him with a crime, or initiate deportation proceedings against him. But I think it actually would not be that much of a stretch to argue that the government could similarly apply Section 412 to this last category of detainees. And then Section 412 would say that these detainees could be held pending their removal from the country, especially if their removal is, as I suspect it would be, legally and politically impossible, or at the very least, impracticable. So I guess all I'm trying to say is that if the question about closing Guantanamo reduces to the absence of authority for continuing to detain those 45 to 70 detainees, I actually think it's not nearly as clear that such authority would be lacking. As for the focus of John's remarks, and whether the detainees would receive additional rights if they're transferred to the United States, I think it's worth stressing that the status quo is not nearly as clear as John's presentation makes it sound to be. So in other words, whether they're going to receive additional rights depends very much on what their rights are today. Of course, the Supreme Court in Boumediene held that these detainees are protected by the suspension clause. Justice Kennedy quite clearly avoided saying anything about any other constitutional protections. And John's exactly right that in Kiemba 1, Judge Randolph, writing for the D.C. Circuit, held that the detainees do not have protections under the Due Process Clause. But I actually disagree with John that Kiemba 1 is so well settled as precedent. And I'm not alone in that regard. One can actually find four or five subsequent D.C. Circuit opinions, where given the subsequent litigation history in Kiemba, with the Supreme Court eventually vacating that decision and then having it reinstated in a separate opinion on remand, different D.C. Circuit judges have assumed without deciding that the Due Process Clause actually does apply at Guantanamo, including no less a figure than Brett Kavanaugh in his concurrence in Kiemba 2. So I guess I'm not as convinced as John is that the status quo is settled, that the detainees at Guantanamo have no other constitutional rights. Indeed, in the context of the military commissions at least, the government has not made that argument in responding to objections to, for example, various of the procedures in the 9/11 trial, the assertion of military jurisdiction at all in the al-Balul and Hamdan cases, and so on. So I think it's worth stressing that it's not as obvious that the status quo is so anti-rights as we might think, and that therefore moving the detainees into the U.S. would upset that status quo so substantially. But even if John is right, so what? And what I mean by that is, so long as the AUMF is still on the books, the government will still have the authority to detain these men even once they're transferred into the United States. Indeed, that should follow from Hamdi. I mean, let's all remember that in Hamdi, we had a U.S. citizen who was picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan. He was transferred to Guantanamo before we discovered that he was a citizen. He was then moved into the U.S. for continuing detention. The government did not argue that he had no due process rights, but the Supreme Court nevertheless held that the government had the right to detain him, and only that the procedures to which Hamdi had been subjected thus far were inadequate. But keep in mind that the procedures that the Hamdi court objected to were the government's argument that Hamdi's detention could be based solely on an uncontested and uncontestable affidavit. Justice O'Connor quite specifically did not mandate rigorous criminal-like proceedings on remand. All she said was that Hamdi was entitled to more, to an opportunity to contest the legality of his detention before a neutral decision maker, which is exactly what Boumediene holds that the suspension clause requires. So I guess I'm not convinced that that moving these detainees into the U.S., even if it does bring with it greater constitutional protections, will actually affect that many of these cases at the end of the day. The AUMF question won't change. Perhaps the government will have to meet a slightly higher burden of proof in showing that they have enough evidence to hold these men. But, you know, the further we get away from 9/11, the less, I guess, I'm bothered by the notion that the government might have to meet a burden of clear and convincing evidence, say, as opposed to preponderance of the evidence, to justify the continuing detention of men picked up 13 years ago. And so I think the real question is not whether the detainees will receive greater rights if they're transferred, but whether those additional rights will make a difference. And my own view is that any difference would be modest at best. And so that brings me to my last point, which is the policy side of this. And that's where I want to say a word about last weekend's events with the Bergdahl Exchange. As most of the folks on the phone are probably well aware, Congress had been legislating ever since 2011 a series of restrictions on the ability of the Obama administration to transfer detainees from Guantanamo both overseas and within the United States. There had been a concerted effort on the part of the Obama administration to push back against these restrictions and to get them watered down and ultimately repealed, and that effort had actually been making progress. So, for example, in the Defense Authorization Act for this year, Congress actually eliminated just about altogether, with one small exception, the transfer restrictions for overseas transfers. So now there's a procedural requirement, but there's no substantive constraint on the ability to transfer detainees anywhere except Yemen. And even for Yemen, all that has to happen is the Secretary of Defense has to make a certain showing to Congress. Congress did not touch the restrictions on transfers into the United States. And I think the thought had been that there might be an opportunity to push forward on scaling back those restrictions as well in the coming year. The problem is that because of the political backlash to the exchange of five Taliban detainees, detainees, by the way, who almost certainly could not have been held following the withdrawal of ground troops from Afghanistan, I think it's entirely likely that Congress will not be at all cooperative in further scaling back these transfer restrictions, and that if anything, Congress might push to ramp them up in the coming weeks and months, and indeed in next year's Defense Authorization Act. So whatever one thinks of the policy or legal wisdom of President Obama exchanging these five detainees for Sergeant Bergdahl, I think at the end of the day, it's going to make it harder politically and perhaps legally for President Obama to carry through on his pledge to close Guantanamo, and it's going to make this problem that much more intractable in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Thanks very much.
Okay. Is there any further comment by you, John O'Quinn?
Sure. Just a couple quick thoughts, particularly on the last point that Stephen just raised. I certainly agree with that. That the recent exchange is very likely to lead to some kind of response by Congress to change the authority going forward and put more restrictions on the ability of the administration to transfer detainees out of Guantanamo Bay. I think that's a likely legal and policy implication of that decision. Stephen raises a couple of other interesting points, and I think I just wanted to reflect on a couple of them. I mean, certainly at some point, and I don't agree with Stephen that we've reached that point, but certainly at some point there will be a question of whether or not the AUMF continues to be applicable for detaining some of these individuals. Now, even when that point is reached, that doesn't end the authority related to the AUMF in the sense that the Supreme Court, the Obama administration argued in the Supreme Court that the government has a certain degree of wind-up authority in order to arrange for orderly resettlement of combatants when hostilities are determined to be over. And as the administration put in its brief, for example, approximately 100,000 Chinese and North Korean prisoners of war who did not want to return to their native countries were held for more than 2 years following the ceasefire in the Korean War. So there is some source of authority to continue to detain. That doesn't ultimately, though, answer the question, and Stephen's absolutely right about this, about where to detain, that is, the United States versus Guantanamo Bay. From a policy perspective, I think there's a very strong case for maintaining that detention at Guantanamo Bay precisely because you have a multi-million-dollar facility that's been optimized for these purposes. But there's also a legal reason as well, and that goes to the category of individuals that Stephen identified for whom perhaps are cleared for release, but there's nobody, there's no country that we are comfortable sending them to, because no country is either willing to accept them, or the countries that are willing to accept them have humanitarian concerns associated with them. If they're present in the United States, it certainly increases the argument or the force of the argument that all they want is simple release, that is to be released from their confinement. When they're held outside the United States, the question is, okay, well, what would release entail? It wouldn't be simple release. It's not literally opening the door and letting them walk out. And that, again, was a distinction that the D.C. Circuit relied on in Kiemba 1 and that the Obama administration relied on in opposing certiorari in the Kiemba case as well. So I do think that that has some significance as you, you know, consider what the legal implications would be from relocation into the United States. And perhaps that is the most important of the implications, because even if authority to detain or the AUMF has come to an end, as it had with respect to, or there wasn't being asserted with respect to the detainees at issue in Kiemba, this doesn't mean that, that these are individuals who would otherwise be eligible for release into the United States. With respect to the individuals at issue in Kiemba, they had all admitted to, for example, participating in weapons training military-style training with hope to attack the Chinese government. Those are the type of qualifications that would render somebody otherwise excludable from the United States. If they had actually been housed here in the United States, would the courts have potentially thought that simple release was available? You know, I submit that they would have, and the risk of that would increase if they're relocated here.
David, this is Steve. Can I just make two brief points in response before we throw
Absolutely.
It open?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, I don't. There's actually not that much that I disagree with here from what John just said. I mean, two very short points with regard to wind down authority. I mean, of course, John's right that the day we pull out ground troops is not the day on which the detainees are released, and it never has been. I would just say though that there's no suggestion in prior practice in international humanitarian law that wind down authority is nearly as long-term as we might think. I mean, the wind-down authority after World War II in Korea was largely a product of the you know, very, very high number of detainees. I mean, John talked about 100,000, you know, Chinese and Korean POWs. You know, we had, you know, similar numbers of German and Japanese POWs by the end of World War II. When we're talking about, you know, a number of detainees that's 200, if we include the detainees who will still be in our custody in Afghanistan, you know, I have to think that the wind-down authority, even if it exists, is going to be measured in weeks and months and not years, as it was after World War II in Korea. And so this is going to be a question eventually, even if it's not, you know, even if John and I disagree on the exact timetable. On the point about release, I mean, I guess let me start by saying that, you know, I'm on record as thinking that the D.C. Circuit was wrong in Kiemba 1 about release. Not that a federal judge does have the power to require the government to admit a non-citizen outside the country into the country, but that the federal courts do have the power, as, for example, the Second Circuit ruled in the Jose Padilla case, to order the government to release or charge a detainee within a certain period of time, and to then hold the government in contempt if it fails to do so. Then it becomes the government's obligation to come up with some solution, including perhaps an exercise of the president's discretion to admit the individual into the United States. But before anyone sort of jumps on that and says, I'm therefore arguing that we should let these detainees run wild in the United States, I mean, let's be clear, there's no question in my mind that if we move detainees into the United States, and if they are released either because they win a habeas petition before the AUMF is repealed, or because the administration just chooses to release them, you know, I have to think that they will be immediately placed in removal proceedings and subject to continuing detention, not under the laws of war, but under federal immigration laws. And at that point, the question will just become whether their potentially indefinite detention pending their removal from the country is constitutional. You know, John mentioned in his opening remarks the Supreme Court's 2001 decision in Zed Vitus, the very last case the court decided before 9/11. And there the court said that there was a presumptive 6-month limit on how long a non-citizen could be detained pending his removal from the country. But Justice Breyer's majority opinion expressly reserved whether the same would hold in cases where the detainees raised national security or counterterrorism concerns, like the detainees would in this case. So, you know, I guess if we're worried about the parade of horribles that would result from transferring the detainees into the United States, I don't think the law is nearly as clear that the second their cases are over, or the second the war is over, they would be free to roam our streets.
Okay, well then I guess we're ready to move on to the Q&A portion. I'm now going to open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you'll hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We'll be answering questions in the order in which they're received. And while we're waiting for the first question to get queued up, I want to make a brief announcement that our next scheduled telephone conference call will be next Tuesday, June 17th at 1 p.m. when we will host a discussion on amending the Bill of Rights. So I invite you to consult the full schedule on our upcoming telephone conference calls and at the telephone page of our Federalist Society website, and visit our podcast page, which includes podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls as well. Again, just for reference, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. And we'll now go to the first question. Once you hear the prompt, your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor, you may ask your question. Well, we don't seem to have any questions just at the moment. I'm going to imagine that so far, John and Steve, you two have done an excellent job of presenting this issue for our listeners. But if there's anything that you'd like to add at the moment, that would be fine while we see if anyone else does have a question.
David, this is Steve. I mean, I guess just to elaborate on something I said previously, if you don't mind, you know.
Sure, no, by all means.
I think it's worth sort of explaining in a bit of detail why the pending en banc D.C. Circuit decision in the Albalua Military Commission case is actually so important to this conversation. You know, I mentioned that the group of detainees who fall into that last and I think most problematic category is somewhere between 45 and 70, and part of why we're not sure about that number is because, you know, the government has said all along that it's 48, now down to 45, but the government has also assumed all along that it's going to be able to try before military commissions the offenses of conspiracy and material support, even for conduct that predated the Military Commissions Act of 2006. What the en banc D.C. Circuit is set to decide in the Albalul case is whether, in fact, that's true. So for a three-judge panel writing in October of 2012, Judge Kavanaugh had ruled in Hamdan 2 that, in fact, the MCA, the Military Commissions Act, could not be used for, at least in Hamdan's case, material support for pre-2006 conduct. If that opinion holds up, if the en banc D.C. Circuit endorses that analysis and the Supreme Court doesn't upset it, then what that's going to mean is that a large number of the detainees who the government had all along thought were subject to trial by military commission now cannot be tried by military commission because there's no way to tie them to more specific acts of terrorism as opposed to these broader enterprise theories of liability. And so at that point, I think the government's going to be faced with a tricky decision of figuring out which of those detainees must therefore be reclassified into this category of folks who, from the government's perspective, are, you know, can't be released. I don't think we really have a good sense yet of how large that group is. What we do know is that if, in fact, the government loses in Albalul, the number of folks who are going to be triable by a military commission going forward is basically going to be 7. It's going to be the 5 detainees currently under indictment in the 9/11 trial. It's going to be Nashiri for his role in bombing the USS Cole, even though that's being, you know, disputed right now in pretrial proceedings. And the last detainee is Al-Araki, who's being tried for actually post-2006 conspiracy, and so therefore raises a different question. So part of why this is such a, I think, ever-shifting conversation is because the law in this field, you know, is still not settled on some fairly fundamental questions.
Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Is there anyone wishing to ask a question? We do have someone who wants to ask a question. As I mentioned earlier, you'll hear the prompt. Your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor, and then you may ask your question.
Yes, I had a question here. One of our colleagues is Adrian Lamo. He's actually the person that turned in Bradley Manning. And my question in the broader sense in that respect is, how unusual is it to have a private attorney handling a court-martial proceedings in that type of case?
Well, this is Steve. I mean, I guess this is a bit afield from this conversation, but, you know, it's unusual but not unprecedented. I mean, the same is true in the Guantanamo context, where, you know, the detainees or in the court-martial context, the accused are entitled to be represented by military counsel, but they're also allowed to hire and retain private counsel if they so choose. And so it's really just a question of the preferences, and at least in some circumstances, either the financial means or the pro bono willingness of outside private counsel to participate. So, you know, it's really a very sort of case-specific question about that individual proceeding.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about traditional, this is John, if you think about traditional court-martial proceedings, it's certainly unusual to see that. But, again, you tie it to the conversation that we're having today. All of the habeas cases involving Guantanamo detainees were cases that were brought by some type of outside private counsel, most of them undertaking pro bono representations, and indeed in the military commissions, I believe most, if not all, of the accused, in addition to having military defense lawyers, have private, presumably pro bono counsel as well, who are assisting. So it's not unprecedented to see private counsel, but particularly if you're talking more traditional court-martial setting, it's very unusual.
Okay, we have a few questions in the queue at the moment, so the next question, you're on.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. There's a popular rumor here in the state of Illinois that the Guantanamo prisoners will be transferred to Thompson Prison just across the Mississippi River from the Quad Cities, because in October 2012, one of our senators, Dick Durbin, announced that the administration and the Federal Bureau of Prisons were buying that correctional center for $165 million, and it had otherwise been set to close in 2010. Any of our speakers have any thoughts or knowledge as to whether the Guantanamo detainees may in fact wind up about 120 miles from Chicago?
Well, this is John. I can't, to borrow a phrase I think that the CIA tweeted today, I can't confirm or deny that. I don't have any specific information one way or another. You know, I do think, though, when you think about potentially relocating them near a large metropolitan area, it does raise questions from a purely policy perspective, setting aside all of the legal issues that Stephen and I have been talking about so far this afternoon, just why from a policy perspective you would want to relocate anyone from the Guantanamo Bay facility to a facility held within the United States. You know, one of the arguments for relocation has been that Guantanamo has become a bit of a rallying cry for recruiting terrorists, that it has symbolic implications. There may be some truth to that, although I submit that would not be any less true of a new facility that was opened within the United States. Conversely, you know, Guantanamo, as I said, has been described by some as being a modern-day Alcatraz. You basically can't get to it. You can't break out of it. You don't have to worry about people, blowing things up in close proximity to it in, you know, domestic terrorism, acts of domestic terrorism. Whereas if you relocate individuals to a facility held inside the United States, those security concerns, I think, are heightened, and the closer to a metropolitan area, perhaps the greater they are. That's a different debate or different discussion from whether or not there are legal ramifications of bringing someone into the United States and what effects it might have on their legal rights. But it strikes me that given the investment, the development, and the isolation of Guantanamo, that's a strong policy reason for not wanting to relocate into the United States.
So this is Steve Vladek. I mean, I think it's worth stressing, though, that we've held plenty of high-profile terrorism suspects at facilities within the United States with no efforts by, any terrorist group, by al-Qaeda, by its affiliates, by a lone wolf to, attack that facility to try to secure the breakout of that prisoner. Certainly there have been no prisoner escapes in this context. So, I guess I'm not quite nearly as concerned about the security issues attendant to moving the detainees into the United States, because I actually think, our federal prisons are pretty darn secure. And I think, you'd be hard-pressed to find relevant examples to the contrary. On the flip side of that, separate from the rallying tool piece of Guantanamo, I mean, I think there's also a sense that Guantanamo is, or at least at various points in time, has been a legal black hole. Now, that's not true today. I think things have gotten a lot better. But, as someone who's traveled to Guantanamo as part of one of these cases, I mean, I think it's worth stressing, it is incredibly difficult if you are a lawyer trying to represent one of these detainees to discharge your duties in the manner that you would do so if you were here in the United States. And so, if our whole goal here is to actually ensure that these detentions actually comport with the rule of law, that the procedures are the same that would be attendant to, high-profile detainees in the U.S., I think moving them into the U.S. actually makes a lot more sense because of just the simple and much easier logistical issues that would result. Now, of course, that's not to say that that's the dispositive factor, but just that I think, part of the problem with Guantanamo, and I think this is an unsolvable problem so long as the detainees remain there, is that no matter how much we improve the procedural fairness, no matter how much we improve the conditions of confinement, it is still going to be perceived by many, both within the United States and overseas, as illegitimate, or at the very least as sincerely troubling from a human rights perspective. And so, I think it's very important going forward for the future of U.S. counterterrorism authority under any president of any ideological stripe to differentiate, to separate out the stains of Guantanamo from the question of whether terrorism suspects can be held without charge for some, period of time. And the problem is that thus far in the U.S. post-9/11 experience, those questions have been inseparable. And so folks tend to think that closing Guantanamo is synonymous with ending detention, when in fact I think they're actually very different legal and policy questions in both contexts.
Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. We'll now go on to the next question.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. When we're talking about the continued detention and prospective release of the Guantanamo Bay detainees, we compare and contrast against POWs from former conflicts, state-on-state conflicts, so World War II, Korea, et cetera. And the underlying assumption is that those people to be released will no longer engage in combat because the state that sponsored their activities is no longer engaged in hostilities. That's not necessarily the case with the Guantanamo detainees. There may be instances where, they're not state-sponsored. They're all not state-sponsored now. But, they're not going to give up their hostilities. They're not going to go home peace or go wherever they want to go peacefully. So how does that variable play into things? And Professor Vladek, I think you just touched on this a little bit, but I was wondering if you could elaborate on instances where they're not going to give up their hostilities. The fight still continues regardless of whether in Guantanamo Bay or they're released.
Sure. I mean, this is Steve, so I'll go first. I guess that there are two separate questions there. I mean, one is, should the law of war authority to detain continue in the context of an asymmetrical conflict like this one? And then the second is, what authorities might exist under domestic law for continuing detention even after, for example, we're out of Afghanistan and or the AUMF is repealed or replaced? And let me take this in turn. On the law of war question, I mean, I think it's worth stressing that there are plenty of folks who would argue that there's no detention authority at all in the context of a non-international armed conflict, that the detention authority in those contexts is not military detention, but rather administrative detention for security purposes. So instead of saying you are part of the German army and therefore can be held until the war is over, you know, the argument is we can say you are part of a terrorist group, so you can be held for as long as the government can show that you are dangerous. And those are very different authorities. I mean, one does not require any showing of individualized threat. That's the, you know, military model. The administrative model doesn't require any existing armed conflict. Thus far, right, we've been operating under the military model, and the Supreme Court has endorsed this, not just in Hamdi, but in Hamdan, that the detention authority the government seeks and claims is detention authority that is tied to the laws of war. And so I don't think you're going to find a lot of support in international humanitarian law for the notion that this kind of military detention can continue in perpetuity simply because you have individuals who might continue to pose a threat after they're released. But, and this is the segue to the second question, I do think there's precedent under both international and domestic law for that kind of argument in a security detention model, where the claim is not that the individual can be detained simply because they're part of a group involved in an armed conflict with us, but because this individual in particular is sufficiently dangerous and is not subject to incapacitation through other less restrictive measures. And I think that's where this conversation needs to go. And at that point, I think, you know, it's worth pointing out that even if there are a handful of detainees who could be held pursuant to such authority, the government would be obliged to prove on a periodic basis that these men continue to pose a continuing threat to U.S. national security. In fact, that's actually the very showing that Section 412 of the Patriot Act requires the government to make in order to continue to detain individuals held under that authority. So I guess what I'm trying to say in a nutshell is that, you know, I think our instinct is that the different nature of the conflict should justify a different model of detention. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but then the different model is one not predicated on membership, but rather predicated on an individual's continuing and long-term dangerousness, a showing the government has not had to make thus far in any of these habeas cases.
Yeah, the AUMF obviously is not exactly a declaration of war, but it's akin to one, and so that has been the source for the president's authority to detain. It's been the source for a lot of the operations that the president has taken, both this president and his predecessor in Afghanistan and beyond. But one of the things about the current conflict that both the question gets at and Steve's answer gets at as well is, you know, to some extent this is this certainly started as a conflict that on some level or another was between nations, in the sense that at the time of the 9/11 attacks, the Taliban were controlling Afghanistan, they were harboring Al-Qaeda and operating from there. But you know, from the beginning, it was understood that this wasn't going to be a traditional war between nations, that it was it involved groups, it involved individuals, it involved loose associations. And you know, I think that is one of the things that the courts have had to struggle with as these cases have been presented, that the executive has had to struggle with right from the very beginning in exercising detention authority. Congress has had to struggle with in exercising supervisory authority here, which is, you know, this is a different kind of war. It has a different, has a different feel to it. It's not, a traditional war between nations, and there are implications for that, both in terms of who you can detain and how long you can detain them and under what circumstances. And you know, as the situation on the ground changes in Afghanistan, certainly it's going to continue to raise questions about the authority to continue to detain, what the source of that authority is, and how the courts should approach it, and what deference the courts should continue to apply in reviewing these types of detention decisions. But I don't think that there are easy or obvious answers to any of these questions.
Once again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. While we wait to see if there are any further questions, any closing remarks from either of you gentlemen?
I mean, this is Steve. I guess, you know, it's important, I think, to separate out the politics from the policy here. And I guess the question is, what is our goal in the long term? You know, if our goal in the long term is at the first step to make sure we're protecting national security, and then the second step to make sure that we're doing so in a manner that best comports with the rule of law. I think it's worth stressing that, you know, continued adherence to a model where, you know, we hold people in perpetuity at Guantanamo is not necessarily obviously best for either of those goals. That is to say, if our real concern is about the ability to incapacitate those who pose a threat to the United States, it's important to understand just how far we've come in the past decade. You know, on 9/11, most of our federal criminal statutes that could be applied to these kinds of terrorist activities did not apply extraterritorially. What that meant in practice was that if we picked up a high-profile terrorism suspect, you know, on September 12th, outside the United States, and we thought he had some loose but non-concrete role in the 9/11 attacks, he wasn't subject to any kind of criminal liability in the United States. If anything, he could only be held under these authorities. That's not true anymore. I mean, so part of why we don't see anyone new sent to Guantanamo, part of why no one new has been sent to Guantanamo since the, you know, before President Obama even took office, is because we now have existing adequate mechanisms for dealing with terrorism suspects other than sending them to Guantanamo. You know, when we arrested Abu Anas al-Libi in Tripoli last year, we sent him to trial in New York. When we arrested Abu Ghaith, Osama bin Laden's son-in-law, we sent him to trial in New York. And so, you know, I think it's important to underscore just how much Guantanamo is a legacy problem and not an issue of forward-looking U.S. authority. Once we agree on that, then the question becomes simply, how do we best solve the legacy problem? And at that point, I'm inclined to say it's worth separating out those detainees whom the government can meaningfully show still pose some kind of security threat to the United States, and those who don't, whether or not they ever did. And that's why I think, you know, a model that's more akin to administrative and security detention, as opposed to the broadsword that is existing law of war detention, is, I think, a much better way going forward for us to reconcile these competing tensions and to ensure that we are simultaneously protecting national security while preserving the rule of law.
So in terms of, you know, more recent decisions and the fact that few have been transferred to Guantanamo, frankly, since the early days following September 11th, a lot of that is a function of policy choices by the current administration to not use military justifications for detention for those individuals and instead to use the criminal system. That's a choice. It's a choice every administration has on how to deal with acts of terror, whether to treat them as acts of war or whether to treat them more as criminal activity. And the Obama administration has certainly favored treating them more like criminal activity as opposed to acts of war. Obviously, each individual, each case is going to, in some instances, be different. Are you talking about, you know, an individual, a lone wolf, so to speak, or are you talking about somebody who's part of a hierarchical or organized organization, whether or not affiliated with a nation state? You have to remember that with Guantanamo, many of the individuals who were detained there were literally picked up on the field of battle. In the days following 9/11, some of them were captured in the areas near Tora Bora and so forth, which was a classic military operation. But the authority under the AUMF is not so limited, and those are policy choices that that every administration will be confronted with going forward. I think when you ask the question over the policy debates about Guantanamo, certainly Guantanamo has become a little bit of a flashpoint. People have turned it into one on the view by some that it was outside the rule of law, and certainly it became less attractive to the military to want to send people there where you would, you know, immediately find habeas cases and so forth being initiated. Having said all of that, you know, the policy question that remains today for those who are at Guantanamo is are two really very separate issues. One is whether they should continue to be detained there versus being detained somewhere inside the United States. There's strong national security reasons to want to continue to detain them at Guantanamo Bay as opposed to relocating them into a facility within the United States. But then second, from the policy question, will be the legal questions of what the implications are. Obviously, continued detention raises new legal questions as the state of the conflict in Afghanistan and more broadly changes. And then there's the legal question of if you have individuals for whom either the AUMF no longer provides a basis for detention, or the administration concludes no longer poses a threat of taking up arms against the United States, but they don't have somewhere to send them to. What is the remedy? What is it that what is it that ultimately happens? And we know some courts, Judge Urbina, would have ordered detainees released into the United States. Other courts, the D.C. Circuit, have drawn distinctions based on the fact that such individuals, even though they no longer posed a threat to the United States or have taken up arms against the United States, could be continued to be to remain at Guantanamo because they couldn't be released into the United States because that would violate U.S. Sovereignty for a court to bring someone in. So that leads to continued legal justifications for wanting to house individuals at Guantanamo as opposed to inside the United States, as some uncertainty remains over how the conflict is going to wind down and how ultimately detention is going to be concluded.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts today, and thanks also to our call-in audience. We welcome your feedback by email, and you can do that by emailing info@fed-soc.org. But please be sure to join us next Tuesday, June 17th at 1 o'clock for our next scheduled telephone call, Amending the Bill of Rights. And until then, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.